Oh, just a minute. Okay, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Rick Collins from Williamsburg. I represent Mr. Coates in this appeal. Certainly, this is not a factually complex case. I would submit that there are really just very few important facts necessary to resolve this issue. As the court is aware, Mr. Singleton found himself in a stall at the Williamsburg Public Library. After situating himself into a bathroom stall, Coates comes into the adjacent stall. Coates starts rubbing Singleton's leg. Singleton pushes it away. Coates starts rubbing Singleton's leg for a second time. Singleton pushes away for a second time. At that point, that's when Coates sticks his head underneath the stall and propositions Singleton, which is the act that leads to the case at bar. The issue for this court to decide is whether Coates' actions constitute not only peeping, which I concede that it does, but secretly or furtively peeping within the meaning of 18.2-130. The Commonwealth cites in its brief, and we've cited it as well in distinguishing it, the Copeland case as well as the Morales opinions. Our argument is not the same that was presented by the defense in those two cases. Our argument is not that this court adopt the definition of secretly or furtively that is synonymous with undetected. Clearly, our argument is not that Coates is not guilty because he was detected by Singleton. Rather, it's that Coates was acting in a manner where he never intended to be undetected, which is contrary to what happened in Copeland and Morales. In Copeland and Morales, the individuals in those cases had acted in ways consistent with the desire to maintain secrecy with what they were doing. Of course, they were caught in the act, and that's how they were convicted. In contrast, in this case, Coates, after he gets into the stall, very clearly announces his presence. He's making physical contact with Singleton, not just on one occasion, but on two occasions. And while I agree with the Commonwealth that Singleton found himself in a vulnerable position, and certainly his privacy was invaded based on what Coates was determined to have done, within the meaning of the statute, Coates was not acting secretly or furtively.
In the case of Callaway versus the Commonwealth from the Court of Appeals, they defined the word furtive. It was in a different context, a different criminal statute, but seems reasonable to me to apply that definition because it comes out of a well-known dictionary. And part of that definition is done by stealth, sneaky, sly. Why isn't looking under the partition wall of a bathroom something that is done sneakily, slyly?
I think in many contexts that would be sneaky. I mean, for instance, in this case, had Coates walked into the bathroom and then immediately got down on his knees or some fashion lowered himself to the ground and looked under to the stall, then we'd have a very different case.
Well, right. I mean, most of us, when we're in the bathroom, frankly, know when someone's in the adjoining stall. We hear them come in. I mean, I hate to be crass about it, but we do.
Yes, and I agree. And if it's not that Singleton would have been aware of Coates entering the bathroom or even entering the stall adjacent to it that makes it that an art we submit takes out of the definition of the statute, it's what Coates does in relation to Singleton. So yes, I agree.
Because he reaches underneath and touches his leg.
Yes.
But he still is looking.
Yes.
He still peeps under that partition wall in a sneaky way to look. Now why isn't that furtive?
I agree that he peeps. I agree that partition wall fits within the definition of the statute, but it's not furtive because he's not doing anything stealthily at that point. He's been rubbing Singleton's legs on two separate occasions, so he's not trying to do anything that...
Well, that wasn't stealthily, but peeping was. Why does it follow? Because you've rubbed someone's leg in the next stall that they're going to now look under their partition.
I understand your point, Your Honor. What I would say in response to that, though, is if the fact that he looked under the partition by itself means he was doing it secretly or furtively, then there would be no reason to have that qualifier within the statute.
So if I understand you, if he had not reached underneath the partition wall twice to touch the victim's legs, but had the first act had been the peeping, then you would agree that he's guilty?
Yes, I would.
So it's only because he reached his arm underneath twice that you say he does not qualify, does not come within the purview of the statute?
Exactly, because it's not, our argument is not that he did things that would have made himself obvious to Singleton. It's that he intended to make himself obvious to Singleton by rubbing his leg. So it's not, you know, obviously the door closes in the bathroom. That makes himself possibly evident to Singleton. That doesn't take it outside the definition in the statute. He closes the stall door. That doesn't take it outside the definition of the statute. But when he starts to make physical contact with the object of the peeping, while again, an invasion of privacy undoubtedly occurs, that's not stealthful at all. And I agree with the Commonwealth in its brief that under normal rules of statutory construction, when the General Assembly uses two different words in the statute, they can't possibly mean the same thing, because that would mean that one of them is surplusage. I focused on furtively in the brief, not only because it was recently defined in a Court of Appeals opinion, but also because furtive is not used as commonly in everyday language. Secret obviously is. So while I agree that furtive and secret must mean different things in the context of the statute, what is clear based on the case law and just the normal definition of these terms is that the act of the defendant has to have some sort of surreptitiousness available in it. And again, because Coates acted in a quite obvious manner, that doesn't fit within the definition of this statute. As the court is aware, in a penal statute, they're construed narrowly against the Commonwealth. Looking at the plain language of the statute, his acts do not fall within the scope of the General Assembly's language. If there are no other questions, I thank you for your time, and I reserve some time for rebuttal.
All right, thank you.
May it please the Court, David Uberman on behalf of the Commonwealth. The evidence at trial was sufficient to support Coates' conviction for peeping under Section 130B of the Criminal Code, and what this boils down to is the parties seem to disagree as to what the definition of furtive is. And Coates contends that the Commonwealth failed to establish this element of furtiveness because he equates furtive, and he defines it on brief, as requiring stealth or requiring surreptitious conduct. And as he concedes on oral argument, however, Section 130B is written in the disjunctive. The General Assembly has said that it shall be unlawful for any person to peep or attempt to peep when he does so secretly or furtively. Therefore, we know those two words cannot be synonymous. In Commonwealth versus Herring, in this very last year, this court held that we'll give effect to each statutory element rather than allow part of the statute to become mere surplusage. And frankly, in Copeland and Morales, both of which were cited on brief, we agree that the fact pattern in those cases is a little different, but I nevertheless think the Court of Appeals' interpretation of the statute is important. In both Copeland and Morales, the defendant was first of all, it was charged under 130A, which is window peeping. And in one case, the defendant was staring at a woman inside through a glass sliding glass door, and she was aware of his presence. In another, in Morales, the defendant was looking inside of a window, and the occupants were unaware he was there, but he was outside in plain view. And in both cases, the Court of Appeals held that the furtive element of this statute does not require the perpetrator of the peeping to be entirely hidden from view. And while this court has previously not defined this term furtive in the statute that we're dealing with today, as we discussed, or as the court previously discussed, the Commonwealth or the Court of Appeals recently did so in Callaway just last year. And they did it in the context of 16.2-53.2, which raises the violation of a protective order from a misdemeanor to a felony when a home is entered furtively. And there the court held that a furtive act does not have to be steeped in secrecy. Rather, it's an act done in a sly, sneaky, or an underhanded way. And this interpretation of furtive, I think, is important because it protects the citizens of the Commonwealth not only from the peeping Tom, who at least for a time successfully conceals his presence from the victim, but it also protects citizens from clumsy or poor attempts at peeping as well. And on his brief, Coates notes that the Callaway court defined furtive as done by stealth, secret, or surreptitious, but he doesn't cite the entire definition. And Chief Justice Kinzer, that was sort of the point that you addressed previously. The Court of Appeals went on to define it as sneaky, sly, underhandedly, or stolen. And in the end, they found no ambiguity in the General Assembly's use of the term furtive in that context. And like in this case, in Callaway, the defendant there, Mr. Callaway, entered the home of a protected party at night by breaking a window in her home. And he claimed on appeal that he could not have acted furtively because the act of breaking the window created such noise that he was not acting in secret or in stealth. And Judge Petty, in his opinion, said that he concluded that Callaway's entry could not have been more furtive. And he said that furtive under that statute did not require, quote, ninja-like stealth, unquote, to qualify as furtive. So while Coates contends that, at least on brief, that the General Assembly sought to criminalize only peeping Toms who act with stealth, I think it's clear from the statute they cast a much wider net. The statute identifies 8 different places and includes a catch-all for any other location or enclosure where someone may have a reasonable expectation of privacy. And significantly, it also substantively defines the offense of peeping as an attempt to peep, which I think is particularly relevant. And this court has addressed the term furtive. It's typically done so in the context of whether or not the police have probable cause to make an arrest and whether or not, usually within the confines of a traffic stop. And 6 cases are cited on brief. I'm not going to bore the court by going through those here, but I think 2 are particularly instructive. And one from 2011, Justice Goodwin, in your dissent, you noted that you discussed furtive behavior and furtive gestures which might support a police search subsequent to arrest. 2 years before that, in Rudolph versus Commonwealth, the court held that we have previously recognized that furtive gestures are relevant in determining whether probable cause exists to arrest. I think it follows that a furtive action, therefore, doesn't have to be completely clandestine. If it were, the police would never be able to observe it because, by definition, it would simply be unobservable. So the definition proffered by Coates runs counter to this court's, at least, interpretation of that word, obviously not in the confines of the statute, but as this court has typically used that word. It runs counter to the Court of Appeals definition of the same in Callaway, and I think it runs counter to the definition that was intended by the General Assembly. The evidence in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth clearly showed at trial that Coates acted furtively prior to peeping into the stall. Singleton, in fact, testified at trial that he'd seen Coates at the library before several times, that he'd stared at him a couple of times. So this was a jury trial. I think it was reasonable for the jury to infer that Mr. Coates saw Mr. Singleton enter the bathroom. He followed him into the bathroom. The victim testified within 40 to 50 seconds he heard someone else come into the bathroom. Coates enters the only other stall. He pulls down his pants. He twice gropes Singleton's leg. He gets onto his hands and knees. Then ultimately, he peers into Mr. Singleton's stall before sexually propositioning him. Singleton, meanwhile, clearly had a reasonable expectation of privacy while he was seated in a closed and locked bathroom stall. And I'd also like to point out that, at least on oral argument, the defendant appears to concede that without the leg touching, the conduct would have been furtive. And I think that's significant because, Justice Ginsburg, as you pointed out, it does not follow that because your stallmate decides to touch your leg that you should reasonably expect their head to appear underneath the stall. I think that's the very definition of sneaky or sly conduct. And even if, again, this was a jury trial, and I think the evidence demonstrated that even pursuant to Coates' proffered definition of furtive, which I think is more akin to an objective definition of secret, that the jury similarly, even on those, with that as a guiding principle, the jury still could have found him guilty of peeping because I think it is reasonable to infer that if someone is getting on their hands and knees in a stall, at some point prior to positioning their head to look up, they're going to see Mr. Singleton, at least from his ankles down, with his pants around his ankles. And the statute clearly penalizes anyone who peeps or attempts to peep on anyone who is in a state of undress, and the circumstances are such that that person has a reasonable expectation of privacy. So the Commonwealth's position is that whether this court decides to look at it as furtive or secret, Mr. Coates' conduct nevertheless qualified under the statute. But more importantly, I think the point is that secretly and furtively cannot be synonymous. The legislature has chosen to write this statute in the disjunctive, and that Mr. Coates' conduct was quite literally the definition of furtive. And unless there are any questions, I'll rest on the remainder of arguments set forth on brief, and I thank you for your time.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal?
I'll address 2 points made by counsel during his argument. To start with, in the Callaway case, citing the opinion there, I think the language which is quoted in the Commonwealth's brief is very important to distinguish it from this case. The last sentence, it says, in the relevant part, Callaway chose the mode of entry most likely to allow him to get inside and overpower the victim before she could detect his presence and react. Obviously, it's very different from this case. It's not that he made noise coming into the bathroom that distinguishes it from Callaway. It's that he didn't do everything in his power to avoid detection, unlike what the Court of Appeals determined or reasoned that Callaway did in the Callaway case. There was nothing that Coates did to try to avoid his detection prior to anything happening. And regarding the use of furtive gestures in the Fourth Amendment context, I agree. I mean, certainly if furtive gestures had to be secret to qualify, there would never be a search or seizure based on furtive gestures. But I think that argument is very similar to the argument that was rejected in Copeland and Morales. It's sort of the equivalent of saying that because you get caught peeping, you can't be convicted of peeping. That's not the argument here. The furtive gestures in a Fourth Amendment context is where individuals are doing something that, while detected, they're trying to avoid detection for whatever they're doing. Usually it takes place within a car. And I think that's an important distinction between what we're arguing here. Of course Coates was caught. Coates did everything in his power to let Singleton know that he was present next door. And the Commonwealth cites a couple of cases on the furtive gestures argument. There's one that he doesn't mention that's cited in brief, which is the Harris case. And he quotes a dissent. I think it's important to distinguish that case from to go into the facts surrounding the dissent in that case. In the Harris case, the majority found that the search was reasonable, but in the facts, in the majority opinion in that case, all they talk about is what's happening while the individuals are driving down Staples Mill Road. The dissent is referring to furtive actions that take place as the police are walking up to the vehicle in that case, but there's nothing in that opinion that states what exactly the dissent's referring to in that case. And I think that's important because the summary, while accurate, refers to overacts. And I think it's important to understand the context in which that statement was made. There were no facts in that opinion concerning what happened when the police approached that vehicle. And so while I agree with the Commonwealth summary of that opinion, I don't think it's as critical based on the context of that dissent. Again, thank you for your time. If there are no other questions, I ask the court to consider reversing this conviction.
All right, thank you. Court is adjourned.
All right.